Hey, on behalf
Primo
of Detroit,
Beats on the chat.
Hey, we want to present these buffs to our governor. Big Gritch.
Throw the buffs on her face,
cause that's Big Gritch.
We ain't even about to stress,
we got Big Gritch.
You can find her in the press
under Big Gritch.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, Jack Spencer, and our special guest this week, Kathy Barks Hoffman, former longtime reporter for the Associated Press, now with Martin Wehmeyer. And the music that introed our podcast today, Detroit rapper G-Mac Cash with his song Big Gretch, which already has, last count on Twitter, 840,000 views on his Twitter page. It's the version that is the full, I think more like 2 minute version, is up on YouTube right now. Kathy, what did you think of that song? Did you just hear that?
That was the first time I heard that, Kyle. Well, you know, it's somebody who's supportive of the governor, which is isn't getting as much publicity these days.
You're not much of a rap fan, are you, Jack?
No, I'm glad Kathy said it was in support of her. I needed her interpretation. It's kind of sounded like it was, but
I think I'm going to listen to it pretty much all day, John.
Good for you. Good for you.
Does that mean you're taking tomorrow off to recover?
All right. So there was a reference in here on this song that I wanted to talk about. Let's start with this and the protesters that were out in front of the Capitol on Thursday. This was a group that was organized in part by Tom Norton, who's running for the third congressional district chair, or third congressional district congressional seat. And a band of folks who call themselves patriots, who kind of appeal to that loose wing of the, it's not really the Republican Party, although they tend to vote that way, but they're more from the whole Michigan militia type wing, I guess, of the Republican Party, the types of folks who are on guard in case things go to hell in a handbasket here in Michigan, and we need some type of armed militia to keep law and order, I suppose. They were at the Capitol, and one of the things that they did is they kind of stormed the outside the chamber and made a ruckus, which isn't necessarily new. But one of the chants that they had was something that I don't know if I've heard before, and that was, "Let us in." Jack, if the sergeants and the state police had actually let these protesters into the House chambers as session was going on, what would they have done?
There was no reason to let them in unless you put together a strategy why you let them in. If you let them in the right way and you have the actual caucus members go in and caucus and just let them sit there and be bored to death forever, watching nothing happen, that would have been pretty effective for those people to come in there and just find out. It might be considered cruel and unusual punishment, but nonetheless. Or the other strategy might have been to quickly arrange for a tour guide and let the tour guide take them all the way through down and out the north door. But you know, we all know they can't let them in. They don't let anybody in.
Well, see, that was my point, Jack. That's why I asked you the question, because I think if they would have let them in and if they would have had the members in their respective caucuses and just let them in the chamber, they might have been very excited once they got in there, but once they got in there, I imagine they'd all just be taking pictures and kind of looking around.
Pictures, and again, if they actually wanted to stay, they'd be bored to tears. I agree with them keeping them out, but yeah, it might have been an interesting strategy to come up with one of the two.
Well, and this is why I bring this up, Jack and Kathy and John, and that is because these protesters, while the images that were popular over social media were very troubling. And I would concur that the images were very troubling. The noose, anything that had to do with a swastika or a Confederate flag. I don't know if that is the prominent visual, though, of the vast majority of these people. And if you want to take a look, I took a picture from the top of the Capitol steps, and it was kind of a panoramic view. And I put it on Twitter. And if anyone wants to go to the MERS Twitter feed and take a look at it, you can. But I spent the good part of the weekend, John, thinking about this and re-looking at that picture. And I looked hard for a Confederate flag. And I looked hard for a swastika. And you can see hundreds of people in this shot. I saw zero Confederate flags. I saw zero swastikas. Now, I saw a lot of American flags. I saw a lot of Gadsden flags, don't tread on me. And I didn't see any social distancing, and I didn't see a lot of masks. I think me and about 20 other people were the only ones wearing masks at that rally. I didn't see a lot of the symbols that people were most troubled with. And I bring this up because in the end, I know that folks were troubled by the guns and so forth that were being carried about. But in the end, I'm not sure that it was more than part of the imagery that they're creating and more of a prop. And I'm saying a prop because nobody was there to take over the government. They were there to represent their type of political viewpoint, which is freedom, liberty, and that they're going to be the people, theoretically, who are going to keep law and order if everything goes to hell in a handbasket.
You know, I think part of the reason that we saw so many images in the media of the Confederate flag and sort of the guns, twofold. First, you know, everybody's under house arrest, and it's a global pandemic, the first probably of its size in 100 years. And there's a lot of people, I think, that are ready to pick a side. You know, you're either pro stay at home, pro take every precaution you can, or you're pro reopen the economy as quick as you can. And there seems to me, and based on sort of my limited reading of social media, that once you're in one of those camps, it's like you're very quick and willing to sort of point to any image that paints the other side in a negative light. I think a lot of the media coverage of Michigan was unfortunate. I suspect, you know, I'm not saying all of the people that were at the protest, you know, were there just to represent a different opinion on the economy. Some were not. Some were there to cause trouble. But a lot of the imagery across or national media was of the one guy with the beard screaming at the state police officer, or it was a swastika, or it was those pictures of the three or four guys up in the gallery in the Senate carrying guns. As much as, you know, I'm proud of a lot of the work that some of the media has done, I think there is sometimes an inclination to show the most inflammatory thing right now. That's kind of the way media works.
And Kathy, you could argue, though, too, and then on the other side, even having one noose at something like this is one too many.
Yes, I think if we're talking about nooses, even one is too many. You know, if you feel compelled to bring a gun to the Capitol to talk about something like this, it's kind of, you know, overstating the problem in a way. I do think that there are plenty of people who have been at these protests in Michigan who are small business owners, or people that are seriously worried that if they cannot start working again, they're going to lose their house, they can't provide for their family. I mean, the food banks are seeing huge increases in the number of people needing food assistance. And quite frankly, even with the federal help, people haven't gotten their checks necessarily, that the $1,200 checks that are supposed to be coming out. I know that a lot of people have, but those haven't gone to everyone. There's been mistakes. Some people haven't gotten the money that they were supposed to get for their children, the extra $500. You know, it's been incredibly impossible to get your unemployment benefits started. So, you know, there are a lot of people who are already right on the brink here. And so it is easy to understand some of the frustration. But, and I agree with John that, you know, it's true that, you know, the most inflammatory images are the ones that get out and shown around the country. And I think that's unfortunate for Michigan because, like you said, we're partly that state, but we're not entirely that state. But I think the bigger deal here is that regardless, you know, if you're showing up to ask that the legislature, which already was kind of leaning your way as far as opening things up, you know, do you really need to be carrying a gun into the Capitol? Do you really need to be shouting at the state police who are just trying to do their job? And quite frankly, whether you really think you need a mask or not, a lot of other people are concerned that they're going to get COVID. I mean, this is still going up. You know, we're starting to flatten the curve here in Michigan. But, you know, you see other parts of the state besides Southeast Michigan where it's spreading more now. And I just think there's a really big concern that people are not following these guidelines. And I think that that's another thing that gets people upset when they see the protesters gathered together and a lot of them not wearing masks.
I think Kathy makes a good point there. I mean, a lot of these people, let's say you're up north and you're 200 miles away from the counties that have gotten the most of it, you've hardly had any, and your business has to be closed, you can understand why those people would be upset. You also have to stop and think, the governor knows, okay, you open that up, well, people are going to be driving up north from and spreading COVID from the southern county. So there's two ways to look at that. I'm also interested in the idea that these are Michigan militia. Now, I was a editor up north in the 90s when the Michigan militia was widely well known and dispersed. The Michigan militia types were everything from somebody sophisticated enough to put a lien on a judge's home and they don't and not have it not even been realized for 9 months, or the kind that would get thrown out of their house because they refused to put in a septic tank. It's just amazing to me. I was a little surprised. I didn't even know the place still existed. I mean, the organization even still exists.
Well, it's kind of like the Tea Party, though, Jack. I mean, it's like this is also the type of fringe part of the political conservative ideology who made up a lot of these Tea Party movements. I mean, they still exist. They just are called different things. And now maybe they call themselves Liberty or they call themselves Patriots or whatever. It's just rebranded, but it's the same type of mentality, what you're talking about.
Well, I think there are a lot of Tea Party people that were more sitting in an armchair and getting a little bit angry. I think the Michigan militia, what I saw as the Michigan militia types were really a narrow stream of people. And I guess that's probably what you were trying to say. Okay, everybody who's there is not the same. You can have a good point or have an honest opinion that you want expressed. And I would be mad if some nut who was on my side was in the corner waving a swastika or something. Always the people who are more representative of more folks, and then there's the ones off in the corner who are kind of nutcases.
Yeah, and you get that on both sides. I mean, you get that fringe. And I think the swastika comes out because they're making the comparison that Gretchen Whitmer is like Hitler and that they were both dictators. And John, can't we come up with another dictator? I mean, is there not another dictator out there that we can make that point? Anytime you bring up Hitler, it's a loser. Okay, nobody is like Hitler. Hitler exterminated mass numbers of people. Okay, there is nobody like him. Please don't compare anybody to Hitler. It hurts your point. Find another dictator. Why don't you just compare to the guy from North Korea or somebody? I mean, there's got to be another dictator you compare somebody to outside of doing the Hitler thing.
I would think so, Kyle. But you know, I'm not sure that protesters are necessarily the most versed in political history to quickly pick out the name of a dictator who has better imagery than Adolf Hitler.
How about King George? Can we go King George? I mean, that's not too deep, is it?
I agree with you, Kyle. It is automatically a loser, automatically, to even go there. There's no way you can say, but I meant this or so on. The conversation doesn't even get started, let alone get far enough for you to explain.
And to be honest with you, using that comparison is wrong in a lot of different ways, because Gretchen Whitmer is trying to do the best she can to protect the state of Michigan, and to compare it to somebody who was responsible for the extermination of millions and millions of European residents of Jewish descent is just wrong.
Kathy, I know that these folks are trying to make a point, but isn't it interesting, though, that they actually hurt their cause and actually helped Gretchen Whitmer by them actually being at the Capitol? Do they realize that it was counterproductive?
You know, anytime you have protests on the Capitol lawn, it's frustration. You know, people don't see things working the way that they think they should. But it is true that the polls just show that the governor is popular with well over 60%. You know, her actions are being favorably looked at, including by Republicans and independents in the state who think that, you know, yes, there are inconveniences to this, but that, you know, Michigan, which still has the third highest number of deaths in the country. I think we're fifth in a per capita basis, but we got hit early with this. And, you know, when your only other examples was what was going on in New York City, she had an absolute right to be deciding that we have to really do something serious here because we are at the forefront of this. She knows that Michigan has people that travel around the state. We all, you know, a lot of people have second homes, or they have a place where they keep the boat, or they take the camper or the trailer for the summer. And she knew if she opened up the state to lots of, you know, she has opened it up to people being able to travel now, but if she did not still have people trying to stay at home, then it was going to spread around the rest of the state as well. You know, she's not just deciding this. She is talking to health experts at the University of Michigan. She's talking to hospital experts. She's talking to a whole lot of people that are in the public health field and study pandemics and know how this goes. She's talking to business people. So she's not making these decisions in a vacuum. And I think that that's what people need to keep in mind. And I think that's why her, you know, still is getting very good ratings from the general Michigan population, is that people feel like she is listening, that she is, you know, she's talking to them most days and telling, explaining herself, regardless of how much gets thrown at her, that she's just doing this for political, you know, to increase her political clout or get chosen as vice president or any of the rest of that. I think at the end of the day, people feel like, you know, no, I can go to a grocery store because, you know, and I don't mind wearing a mask. And I think most people get the fact that you're wearing a mask to protect other people. It's not just about you. I understand the frustration, and I know that's generally why people show up at the Capitol lawn. I've covered many a protest over the years, but I think that you're right. They're not doing themselves much good. And, you know, to be honest, when the president tweets that the governor should strike a deal with people, as she says, it's not a negotiation. It's not a political, you know, you start there, I start here, let's meet in the middle. There are public health scientific reasons why she has to do what she's doing. And I think most people feel like she has done that well.
One other thing I want to ask you about, Kathy, is Governor Whitmer's response to the Joe Biden sexual harassment claim that has been made. Have you heard her response, and how do you think she's doing?
I did hear her response. I think it's a difficult position for, especially for any woman to be in, and especially for somebody like Gretchen Whitmer, who has been, you know, sexually attacked and was a victim, to strike the right balance. Everybody who's paying attention to this is waiting to see if there's anything more here. But I think that you're seeing a lot of women and women in politics, women in other places, saying, you know, the Joe Biden that I have known to this point was not that person. You know, there's not a history of things like this, like there is, quite frankly, with President Trump. You know, now a lot of those allegations have not been proven either. So I think that she said what she said. She said that the woman deserved to be heard, and that, it, you know, we should find out what actually happened, but that she, the Joe Biden she knows, would not have done that. And I think that's about as good an answer as you can get at this point.
Kathy Barks Hoffman with Martin Wehmeyer, formerly with the Associated Press. Thanks for zooming in with us here this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Jack, you brought up a real good point here that I really want to expand on, and that is kind of the difference within the Tea Party movement. Because the Operation Gridlock protest we had a couple weeks ago, where the streets of Lansing were all jammed up, was organized by people who had Tea Party backing. We're talking about Marion Sheridan. We're talking about the Maddox. I mean, these are people who also came from a Tea Party movement. But even within the Tea Party, there's different spectrums. I mean, you have a Tea Party movement, and Tea Party is now kind of an outdated term, but you have people who were within the movement who have been associating themselves with Donald Trump, but you also have people on various other different spectrums. And I guess that's what I'm saying. The people who were at the Capitol on Thursday were on the spectrum that were far right of even the Maddoxes and, you know, kind of the mainstream Tea Party, if there is such a thing.
That's part of why the Tea Party is, the term Tea Party has kind of lost its meaning, because they couldn't get along well enough among each other to even really keep the real movement going. And I gotta believe there are a lot of Tea Party people who were so into the massive debt that they don't like Donald. And I remember their big thing for some of them was the nation's overwhelming trillions and trillions of dollars of debt. Now they're going to be more aligned with Never Trumpers. If you really paid attention to how that played out, you got to the point where you couldn't just say this person's a Tea Party, or, you know, nearly you had to say which Tea Party, because the one in this county or the one in this city, you know, maybe only agreed with 60% of the stuff that another one agreed with. Whoever shows up at these rallies, I would be far angrier if I was protesting somewhere and had one of these people acting like an idiot. someplace else, and here you are. Well, I was at the protest. I was trying to make a point, and here's some nutcase who's sucking up all the oxygen and all the film and everything else that's taken and shown across the country.
Yeah, exactly, because it's not the picture that I took from the top of the Capitol steps with all the American flags and the Gadsden flags. It's that one picture of that Yahoo with a noose, you know, somebody screaming at a state police officer. I mean, that's the images that you take away from that particular rally, where maybe the vast majority of them are Americans who just want their liberties and they feel like they've been taken away. And now joining us on the Zoom call.
People, right, Kyle?
Yeah, Josh Pugh, spokesperson for the AFL-CIO, is joining us here. And Josh, we've been talking about this rally that happened on Thursday. And what Jack and I and Kathy and John have been talking about prior to you coming on here is that this was a fringe of kind of the remnants of Tea Party, Michigan Militia, people who are describe themselves as patriots, as if the entire state is going to fall into some type of chaotic state where we need people to rise up and take arms like this is 1776 and protect our freedoms and liberty. But what was portrayed on the media, I think, especially on the national stage, was much different. I wanted to get your perspective on this, Josh.
Well, I think it's a little of both, right, Kyle? When you talk about the Patriot Movement, this is actually a fringe group that sort of cropped up most famously and publicly during the Obama years as really anti-government, some kind of ugly, racist, white supremacist, anti-immigrant undertones. But that's what that means when you see the three percenter flag, the guys wearing all their tactical gear with a patch that says crisis actor, which is a nod to Sandy Hook and Parkland shootings being staged, right? It is all sort of merged together. I think it's right that there were a number of sort of conflicting themes, right? There were the militia guys, but also the founder of this group and organizer of the protests started this group because she's anti-vaccinations. And the two women who are at the heart of this and really got the whole thing rolling, at least as it pertains to this April 30th thing, they're anti-vaxxers. And so the biggest conclusion that we could draw is that there wasn't really one call to action.
Yeah.
Right? They were sort of all over the map. And I think that certainly Republicans in the legislature were probably a little caught off guard and surprised by what they saw. I think they were expecting the Tea Party, and they got a Klan rally. It was really outlandish.
You know, there's two types of protests, and Jack's actually taught me this, and I think it's right on, where you have protests where you have people who are mad at somebody within the building, let's say the legislature who is acting on something, and then you have people who are just protesting the building. They're just shouting kind of at the building. Like, so for an example, the right to work rallies or prevailing wage rallies, they were mad at the legislature, which was actually inside the building. Whereas, let's say you had the pink hat rally outside when Trump got inaugurated, they were mad at the building. And this was kind of more of the former because Whitmer wasn't in the building. Maybe she was at the Romney, but she was not there. If they had been let into the House chambers, they would have seen no Gretchen Whitmer. She wasn't on a throne with a crown on or something like that.
Well, they were mad at a whole lot of different things, right? There were protesters there that were mad at Sergeant Dixon. There were protesters there that were mad at the legislature, right? You see a little bit of this on social media, but also the yelling. They thought that the Republican leaders were going to cave. Or they recognized that, in fact, the sergeants of the House do work for Lee Shatfield, not the governor. But yeah, I think that's right, because, again, their anger and frustration and what they were actually asking for was sort of all over the map, right? They were advocating that they make a deal, but then I think Craig Mauger was the one that heard some of the reactions to the bills that the House was passing, and they were saying, well, wait a second, we don't want to wear masks at all. We don't want to wait 2 weeks for bars to open. We want to go across the street to tavern right now. Again, I think the Republican leadership was sort of expecting one thing, and what they got really caught everybody off guard.
How much of this, though, guys, do you think is just the factor of, look, this is really a kind of, if you're not very familiar with state government and you're not following the ins and outs, it's pretty confusing. You've got two orders, one that ends at the end of the month, one that ends on theoretically on the 15th. You've got sort of, nobody understands the sort of the dynamic over the Emergency Powers Act, the two acts, and the conflict between the governor and the legislature. And I think a lot of people just came, as you said, Josh, just came at this for their own interests. And it was a confluence of all sorts of different stuff, including some, quite frankly, nasty stuff, as you mentioned. But it seems like a lot of this, people just don't understand what's happening here just from a procedural standpoint.
Mm-hmm. But I think some of that confusion has been fostered and inflamed by Republican strategy on this from the get-go, right? If you look at the bill that was passed and you look at sort of their negotiating position, they not only started out very close to what the governor was proposing, but they ended there too. And they really won a lot of concessions from the governor in terms of a geographic approach, construction reopening this week. But then their social media message was one that was much closer and in alignment with what the protesters were saying. It seemed like the Republicans, regardless of whether they wanted to pretend like there was some grievous affront to their sensibilities on Wednesday or not, were sort of boxed in because she had made a number of concessions that were really close to what they were already asking for, but they were still, their public posturing and position on this issue was still just anger. And so when you look at the Senate Republicans putting out graphics on social media that say reopen Michigan now, but then you compare that to the plan that Shirky released that says, you know, we need to see a really statewide decline in numbers before we're willing to even get to phase one. There's really a huge disconnect there that I think is fostering a lot of that confusion and really feeding into a lot of that anger.
That's a good point, Josh, because if you take a look at how the governor has acted and where the Republicans are at, it's all just kind of a matter of timing. It seems like she is actually moving in their direction, just maybe not fast enough for them, but she is opening lawn services. She did decide, okay, we can go ahead and do the motorboats. We can do the golfing. Real estate people can open. Construction will open here on the 7th. So she is moving in that direction, but she doesn't want to lead the parade on this thing. She'll let a state like Georgia, if they want to go ahead and try and reopen the state and see their cases go spiking upward, let them go ahead and make the mistake. But that mistake isn't going to happen in her watch.
And that's sort of the incredible thing about all this is that disconnect. It's sort of, it seems like, and especially with everything else going on in the news cycle, it can seem very disorienting at times. Because if you look at what the governor has done in real terms, right, what she's actually done from a policy perspective over the last week or two, I wouldn't be surprised if we are moving more quickly to reopen the economy than even Shirky called for in the first place. But because we're doing so, right, because Dr. Khaldun said so, and because the epidemiologists at DHHS said so, and not because the Republican legislature says so, it really seemed over the last week of legislative session like they were taking actions so that they could position themselves as taking credit for this. And then for whatever reason, a switch flipped, and it became clear that they were just going to now call her a tyrant rather right. than trying to position themselves as being partners and being involved in the whole process. And now, as they sort of mull over whether they even want to pursue legal action, it just seems like what they want here isn't a policy outcome. It's a perception outcome of being viewed as if they're important. But when you contrast that with the fact that they're taking extended vacations and not scheduling session and not doing anything, there's a real disconnect there, and it makes it hard to figure out what a solution could be that would make them happy.
Well, I think the switch that got flipped were constituents, small business people, et cetera, being upset. And what I hear from relatives and so on, the head scratchers are the things about, you know, which are not even in force anymore. But nonetheless, you know, the thing about you can't have a boat with a motor, you can't buy seeds. You can't buy paint, which was, you know, actually from the original order in March, in which if you come at it from the point of view of, well, this isn't any more dangerous than something else, it makes no sense. But the point is, the governor wasn't coming at it from that point of view. She right. was just saying, we're only going to allow businesses to open who sell necessities. So it's a real kind of a mental flip to understand, no, the reason that my neighbor, who's a landscaper, couldn't work for a while was not because the governor said landscaping was more dangerous than buying Cheerios. It was because the list started with, we only allow businesses to work if it's a necessity. That's what people are getting confused. And I would say there was a certain point here where the lawmakers listening to their constituents didn't exactly go out of the way to explain why the governor had done that. I mean, are we surprised? I'm not so sure we're surprised. But I'm telling you, nationally, a lot of people in the other 49 states still think all of those rules are still in force when they were put in force in March, and they're done with. She's moved on.
I mean, when you think back to the lead up to that, you know, what we were hearing anecdotally from across the state. I have a brother-in-law who is going to school and working at Lowe's part-time right now in the garden center. And so that was a frustration both of his and at the manager level, and I assume of the Retailers Association. You know, when you got somebody going to your small business garden center, like Vets here in Lansing or Horrocks on the west side, they're not going and browsing and spending 2.5 hours. But the folks were going to Lowe's and to Home Depot, and that was what that was meant to cut down on. It's just that the switch that flipped was this partisan pushback on that, and the picture of a car seat getting roped off in Walmart. And we were at that point a month or more into this, and there had been some, like Jack said, confusion and misinformation that was spread below the surface. But once that became embraced by the Republican Party writ large, it suddenly became a much bigger deal, and it suddenly became a certain negotiating position that they have not backed down from, even in the face of the governor loosening a lot of these restrictions.
Well, we are definitely a passionate state. You can say that for sure on both the far left, the far right. We have no problem sharing our opinions and our frustrations when we get wound up. And sometimes that doesn't put us in the greatest light. Speaking about this divide now that we're seeing with the legislature and the governor, they've got a big problem on their hands that we got to deal with, John. And I wanted to touch on this briefly, and that is this massive budget hole we're going to have. And if the federal government doesn't bail us out on this, and we're actually going to have to make some decisions. You actually had an interesting idea that if the legislature and the governor could come to an agreement on it, might be a solution given this real immediate and serious problem.
We recently, last week, had a webinar with the Citizens Research Council and sort of addressed this, the financial issue the state's facing. And I had been talking to a number of different lobbyists, and the question that I had was, and I asked the CRC, was, could the state not bond its way to a position where we're going to get through 9 months or 12 months of fiscal uncertainty? And the answer was, it does have the capacity, but for that size of a general obligation bond, it would have to go in front of the voters, which means obviously the majority leader, the Speaker of the House, and the governor would have to sit down. The legislature would have to put it on the ballot in fairly short order, and they would have to define it. And the question is, could you not devise a bond whereby there would be a process where you wouldn't borrow the funds if you didn't need them, but you would have access to them in case the federal government didn't bail you out? And one of the questions, one of the reasons I asked that is because if you think about our general fund, you can go through and you can say, all right, cut 20 to 30% out of every single budget. But our general fund is pretty well restricted. When you think about Health and Human Services and its Medicaid program consumes a huge amount. Corrections consumes a huge amount. You're left with some pretty tough choices about cutting local revenue sharing even more. Those communities are also going to be hurting. So, sort of in the concept that this is a once in every 100 years pandemic we have to deal with, could you not borrow or set up some kind of a bonding authority with the voters' approval to borrow the money necessary as a bridge to tomorrow when this pandemic is behind us?
Well, I think that brings up an interesting point here, because you're exactly right. We've been through this exercise before, John, haven't we? And what ends up getting cut? revenue sharing, universities, and some kind of shell game with schools where schools end up getting cut. That's where all the money is. I mean, you can talk about getting rid of, you know, the Department of whatever, civil rights, or you can get rid of the Department of State. That doesn't really save you anything. I mean, it's really the money that goes to revenue sharing, universities, and schools. That's where the money is. And so if you want to make those cuts, that's where it's going to be, unless you want to raise revenue. And Josh, what do you think the odds are that they want to cut or they want to raise revenue?
Well, and the subtext of that too, Kyle, is the reason that the money is there is because that's thousands and thousands of jobs across the state. Those are things that working people depend on even more than whether or not they can go to Lowe's and the garden center's open, right? And so we really have a situation here where, again, back to this sort of this negotiating position where they're close together, but there's some hurt feelings that are getting in the way of this. If we're going to work through not just the near-term crisis, but the medium and long-term budget crisis, we've got the leaders of two chambers who are going to need to suck it up and get over these feelings real quick, because there is work that needs to be done, whether we're bonding and going to the ballot or whether we're just working together and solving this in the legislature. They're going to have to work with this governor.
Jack, what do you think of the idea of raising the gas tax? I mean, the Mackinac Center had an interesting idea as far as making LARA completely restricted funds and just raising fees on various professions and that you basically pay for yourself, which is an interesting idea. But, you know, when gas is $1.50 right now, all of a sudden 45 cents and moving it up to $2 is like, eh, so what?
I don't think you're going to find very many people that will vote for it.
No, but isn't that an interesting irony? I mean, last year we were talking about 45 cents and people were pulling their hair out thinking, oh my God, we can't do that. Now that oil is basically being given away on our shores and it's $1.50 a gallon, just think about that. We could raise it 45 cents tomorrow and there'd be hardly any outcry.
Trouble is, I think everybody, myself included, considers that a temporary situation. 6 months, maybe, I don't know how long. Maybe it'll be permanent. I don't know, but I just think you'll have a terrible time getting even some Democrat. I mean, will a Democrat now put up a bill for it? We have to wait and see, but I don't think so. And also, I think we saw last year what the Republicans can do, and it wouldn't shock me with their apparent inability to agree with the governor. They simply passed the budget and left town. And then basically dared the governor to veto it, and I don't know how that plays out.
All of a sudden, John, your bonding idea doesn't sound all that bad, particularly if this recession or depression we're in is short term when everybody comes back and, you know, let's say the economy just kicks back in again.
Well, and think about it, too. I mean, we have the budget stabilization fund, but that would only cover less than, I think, a third of the fiscal issues that just the state is facing this year. And, you know, as a small business owner, we've always maintained a credit line that thankfully we rarely have to use. But when you do, you need it. And I guess I don't know why you couldn't create a bonding based credit line for the state in cases of emergency just like this.
All right. Well, John, Jack, and Josh, thank you for that. We're going to move on to our interview that we had a little earlier with the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. Join us now on the other end of the line is the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Kyle, it's always a pleasure to come on the MERS podcast. Thanks again for having me.
We need to get your opinion on a lot of things going on in Lansing right now. First thing out of the box, do you believe the state of Michigan is still under a state of emergency?
Well, Kyle, I think the law is pretty clear here in our state that for any state of emergency to be extended, it requires an act of the legislature, and we need to approve of it. Now, you well know, as do your listeners, that we decided not to extend the state of emergency on Thursday, but rather we codified certain bills, executive orders that we believe should be in the form of bills that we thought were important under the state of emergency and put those on the governor's desk. So because we didn't extend, I think the law is clear. Obviously, the administration has a different opinion. But we have three branches of government, Kyle. There's the legislative branch, there's the executive, and there's the judicial. And sometimes when there's a big enough disagreement between the legislative and the executive, the third branch gets involved. So I do believe, Kyle, that all of her orders subsequent to Thursday are legally questionable at best.
So if somebody comes up to you back at home in Levering and says, are we still under a stay-at-home order? Should I be staying home? What do you say?
I will tell them the law is clear. The only way a state of emergency can be extended is by legislative approval. So I would encourage them to use reason, common sense. I would encourage them to follow social distancing guidelines. And I would also encourage them to talk to their local officials on how they're dealing with that. Because, Kyle, at the end of the day, not only does a one-size-fits-all not work, the legislature spoke on Thursday. We wanted to work with the governor. The fact is, I have heard, you know, for the last month or two, right, our governor and many governors say, we are all in this together. And I couldn't agree more. We are all in this together. But, Kyle, if we're all in this together, we should all find a way to work together. And I think returning to the regular democratic process is the responsible thing to do right now, because I do believe we can prioritize public health. I do believe we can take COVID-19 very seriously, yet be more reasonable in our approach. And that's what the legislature did on Thursday. And that's probably what I would tell one of my constituents, to use common sense, basic reason, individual responsibility. But I would tell them I believe her orders are questionable.
So basically, you don't think we're still under a state of emergency?
Again, I think the law speaks very clear on that, Kyle.
All right.
I think we need to take this very seriously, but the legislature did not act. Obviously, it's no secret in town. There's a disagreement. And Kyle, not only do I think the law is very clear, logic is as well. And here's what I mean by that. For anyone who believes that this governor or any future governor can unilaterally extend the state of emergency for as long as he or she wants in perpetuity, therefore rendering the 1976 law and the legislature completely meaningless, does not understand a foundational element of checks and balances and separation of powers enumerated within not just our state constitution, but also our federal constitution. There's always a check and a balance. You're telling me, or whoever says that, no, the governor has this authority, that a governor can come in, declare a state of emergency, and keep it for as long as they want for the duration of their term is the extreme of that belief. And that's why it's not only does it not follow the law, it also lacks logic.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, what are the odds that you're going to pursue legal action against the governor that challenges the use of continuous emergency declarations?
Well, I think when you asked that question, you probably thought on a scale of 1 to 10, it was probably a 1 that I would answer that question the way that you asked it, and you were probably right. So I probably won't get into a specific on that, Kyle. But I'll tell you, we're going to keep all options on the table. I think that's a responsible thing to do. There's a different specifics I won't get into. I just don't want to comment on potential upcoming litigation. So I will leave it at that, Kyle. It's an option that we have. It's an option we are willing to take.
So on Thursday, the House passed legislation that picked various gubernatorial executive orders and extended them by the dates the legislature thought were appropriate, which you've already mentioned. Now, obviously, the governor says she's not going to sign that bill. Why not pass a legislation then that would have only extended legal protections for first responders, which the governor acknowledges is the legal hole with doing what she's doing, which is extending emergency executive orders without legislative approval?
We thought that was important, Kyle, and we thought there were other executive orders that were important as well. And if we're going to return to the democratic process, we need to not only prove that we can do it in a safe way, but show the governor in good faith that we are willing to take this step with you. This is not about who's right. This is truly about what's right. And it's our system of government, Kyle. And we took many executive orders that the governor has put into place through the executive branch, and we codified those. I mean, that is a sign of good faith. Listen, we're not changing everything you've done. We think there's a lot of benefits and positive things you've done. And to prove that, we're putting this on your desk. I was disappointed, Kyle. I really was. I thought we had a chance here in Michigan to prove that we could work together. This is an unprecedented challenge, and that requires an unprecedented amount of partnership. And, you know, we've heard a lot about working together, being collaborative. This was a chance to show it. This was a chance right here to build bridges. This was a chance right here to prove that you could be pragmatic and reach a consensus. And instead, our invitation, our hand, it was snubbed. And we have a governor that says, I'm going to go it alone, an unprecedented move That has never happened in the history of our state, and it hasn't happened for a reason, Kyle, because the law does not allow it.
So on Thursday, those gathering out in front of the Capitol referred to themselves as patriots. Do you believe they were patriots?
Well, Kyle, I don't think you can lump every single protester into one group of individuals. All right, I think it's improper to do that. Now, I saw some signs out there. I heard some language out there that was reported to me that was said that I think is completely inappropriate. I think it was across the line. And I think while they have the right to protest and right to share their frustrations with government, that's a very American thing to do since our birth, there's a way to responsibly do it. And I still encourage people, yes, follow basic social distancing guidelines. Yes, you can protest, but do so in a responsible, respectful manner. Some of that I saw out there, I thought was disgraceful, Kyle. I really did. And I think we can do better than that. But to lump everyone into one category, I think is lazy. I think it's inappropriate.
Unlike the Operation Gridlock protest, where the people, by and large, tried to stay in their cars, the protesters out there Thursday did not. Do you think the police could have or should have ticketed them for not following the executive orders on social distancing and wearing masks and so forth?
Again, Kyle, people have a constitutional right to show up and protest. They really do. And I think I imagine that the events would have probably escalated had that been attempted. And I think that's probably why the police did not do it. Obviously, the Michigan State Police were here. They did not do that. I think they made the right decision by allowing people to exercise their constitutional rights.
As a general policy, and not necessarily just focused on this past Thursday, but on a general policy, do you support people being able to bring their firearms into the state capitol, but having to leave their signs at the door?
Well, again, people have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. You know, it's something that we've debated in these chambers. We've debated in Washington, and there's some disagreements about that right between parties. People have a right to keep and bear arms. They have a right to do so responsibly. This is the people's house. This is the people's capital, and they have constitutional rights. You have to be very careful before you say you can exercise one constitutional right by coming and protesting, but you can't exercise another. And so I do support people having the ability to exercise their constitutional rights in a responsible way, Kyle. I'm certainly not going to say anything other than that. Now, we also have rules and policies of bringing in signs and different demonstrations that we have here at the Capitol that I think are appropriate and should stay in place.
Last thing I want to touch on is a session going forward. Obviously, the session looks like you guys are going to meet a regular schedule now, Tuesday through Thursday, from now until the end of June. What do you envision sessions and the committee schedules and so forth looking like? Is this going to be kind of a return to kind of normal, or how do you feel like these sessions are going to go?
Well, Kyle, first let me say this. I don't think the coronavirus is going anywhere anytime soon. I think it's going to be with us for the foreseeable future. And what I think that should force us to do is to begin evaluating how we can do things in a safer way and beginning to make that transition now. That's what the legislature is going to do. We're going to lead by example. We still need to work for the people. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. The budget needs to be completed. There's several major policy reforms that are still beneficial for our state that we have to get to work on. But you are going to see a change in protocol. You are going to see different standards and traditions that we've had for a while slightly altered to ensure we're doing it in a safer way, following CDC recommendations. So you'll see a change beginning next week and what that looks like. We're going to be focusing on legislation and items that we feel are important right now, but we're going to be changing the way that we do it. It'll be an unprecedented protocol. We set that standard last week in the House chamber, and you're going to see a continued effort moving forward to make sure that staff, members, or any guests that attend are safe when they're here, and our government still has to move forward, Kyle. Our governments have worked through civil wars, world wars, and they never shirked their responsibility during that time. And right now is no different. Our people need people working for them, and their voices need to be heard. And if we're not here, then unfortunately their voices are silent in these halls, and that's unacceptable during a pandemic.
I'm sorry, just one more question if I could. Obviously, there's now a statutory requirement on having the budget done by July 1st. Is there any chance of that?
Well, we are working very diligently to ensure that that is upheld, Kyle. And I know our appropriations chair, Shane Hernandez, has worked with Senator Stamos, and they've had multiple conversations with the budget director for the governor. And we are moving forward. We're going to do all we can to make sure that our budget is done on time. And you know the July 1st deadline requires that we present a budget to the governor. Does not necessarily mean that obviously she has to sign what we present her, so there could be continued negotiations. We're going to have to make some tough decisions this year, Kyle. This is something that none of us saw coming. It's something that none of us planned for. And as we've already seen, there's going to be some alterations moving forward. So we want to make sure we're working in a bipartisan, collaborative way right now. There's going to be some disagreements, of course. We know we believe different things and have different values that I think our parties are built on. But we're going to work through it, and we're going to make sure that the budget gets done and the people of our state are served, because that's what they deserve.
The Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Kyle. Always.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the crew here. And John, you know that things are coming back to normal when it's a Monday morning and you hear the nice hum of the lawnmower outside MERS World Headquarters.
Yep. Luckily, it didn't happen during the podcast, though.
It just happened during our planning session, which I guess is okay.
I can't do these talks and mold the lawn at the same time, so it doesn't come through in my house.
Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.